Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell here, and Bruce Pratt as well with this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. As we welcome to the program the author of a wonderful new book entitled Pitching in the Promised Land, a story of the first and only season in the Israel Baseball League, Aaron Pribble joins us. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Like you, I am a high school teacher, and I hope your Zoom meeting went better than the one I tried to have with my students with some pretty shaky internet earlier today.
Things were pretty good. No Zoom bombs today, so if nobody's Zoom bombing class, I consider it a win.
Well, the book is such a fascinating read, a story that, frankly, I had no idea about. And, well, right from the beginning, when you were classified as a five, which I didn't understand right away either. Can you talk about the genesis of all this and how you became involved with this?
Sure. Well, first of all, just to start, the genesis of the league was that there's a guy named Larry Barris, who's an entrepreneur, made his money selling cream cheese filled bagels to the U.S. military, called it the Unholy Bagel. Cream cheese right in the bagel. You could take it and you could go. He's been on the Food Network and stuff like that. And he basically had two loves. He had a love of baseball and he had a love of the state of Israel. And he, maybe like the Unholy Bagel, wanted to marry both those things. So he had an idea. Hey, let's bring baseball to Israel. Let's make it happen. And then he set about the difficult task of the logistics and getting people to come and play in the league. And I was one of those players.
One of the things that struck me about the league was what you just said about trying to sort of marry the American pastime to Israel, a country I was in, but a long, long time ago, 50 years ago. And so Dan Duquette was the director of player personnel, but Ron Bloomberg, Art Shansky, and Ken Holtzman, all Jews, and were part of the league. Dr. Ruth threw out the first ball. Was there a sense that this was a game that would naturally be the Israelis would develop an affinity for?
I think there was. I think that was mixed with sort of a sober mindset that this is going to be a tough thing to do. But crazier things have happened in Israel. You know, I played in France and Germany and a few other places. And when you try to bring America's pastime to different countries, the first thing that you inevitably hear, they say, what are you doing here? And you say, I'm playing baseball. And they say, baseball? Like in Israel, we don't have this sport in this country. We don't have baseball here. People were incredulous. They did not believe that actually baseball was being played in Israel. So that was a bit of an uphill battle to get people to realize that the sport was here. But some games were showed on television, opening day, the All-Star game, I think had several thousand people there. So it's not like it was an overnight success story. But I do think that the more people were introduced to the game, the more they liked it. I should just add one coda to what you said, which is Sandy Koufax was also drafted symbolically as the last player in the league. And that's a pretty cool thing, too.
Yeah, we mentioned that at the head of the show. Could you also talk a little bit about the different kind of living conditions that you were experiencing as perhaps compared to people in the majors?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This was, I played just a very little bit of minor league baseball here in the States, and you get used to long, long bus rides and poor living conditions. This was pretty interesting. We were living on a kfar, which was basically like a kibbutz or a commune, a converted one that was basically a school. So everyone was packed together in dorm rooms. The living conditions were not good whatsoever, but there was this weird sense of camaraderie. You're living with your teammates, you're living with your opponents, you're taking bus rides to the field with your opponents together. It was a truly bizarre thing. If I could add one more thing in terms of the field, there was one baseball field in the entire state of Israel when we went. They built a second field and this place called Sport Tech, which is just outside of Tel Aviv. 2 weeks into the season, they were plowing under the soccer field, facing protests from daytiming soccer players who didn't want their sacred ground plowed under for a baseball field. The other field was a converted softball field. So what do you do if you have a field that's too short, but it's almost a baseball field? Well, you just move the fence back another 20, 30, 40, 50 feet. Problem with that, there's a light pole in the middle of right field. What do? You duct tape a mattress around a light pole and you hope nobody gets hurt.
There was also, I thought it was fascinating, Aaron, to read about the hierarchy that existed within the IBL, and it wasn't based on talent as much as where you were from.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think that the Israel Baseball League had a bit of an identity crisis Some people have been trying to understand what the state of Israel is, what it means to be a Jew. I think that's kind of a quintessential, a timeless question. I think the Israel Baseball League needed to figure out what it wanted to be. Did it want to be the best baseball league in Israel, or did it want to be the best Israeli league? And I think as a result of maybe not really knowing what the right answer was, they opted for a combination of the two. So every team, it was an unspoken rule, was required to have some Jewish players, and it certainly did. But for every really Jewish player, you might want to balance it out with somebody else. So I think when the league really became bona fide was when it went to the Dominican Republic and recruited a number of Dominican players. And when we were first starting out, we could kind of judge which team would be the best based on the number of Dominicans that it had on the team, because there was some really, really top-notch talent. There's a guy who played in the professional leagues of Japan, number of minor league ball players. So it kind of had this question that it was trying to wrestle with. And as a result, I think you had this interesting combination.
You also were on your own personal journey in many ways, and I found that honestly to be the most compelling part of the book. To have the courage to go to the West Bank and to confront things that a lot of people don't want to confront in this world, that really impressed me. And as you look back on that now, a dozen years later, how does that experience still resonate with you?
Yeah, thanks so much for saying that. The day and change that we had in the West Bank with me and my buddy Nate Fish, Nathan Israel Bloomberg Fish, the day and a half that we had there were two of the most impactful days of my entire life. You know, going over there, you mentioned that it was kind of a voyage of self-discovery for me. My mom's Jewish and my dad's not. Believe it or not, I grew up, not that we were super religious, but I actually went to church more than I went to synagogue or anything as a kid. So it was very much me trying to understand myself. And as you mentioned at the top, the bag check lady sticking a five on my bag, which meant not Jewish. So I'm going to Israel to try to learn more about myself, trying to play in this league. They stick a five on my bag and send me to the extra security line with all the people who are not Jewish, really said something to me. So then I'm trying to understand myself. I'm trying to understand Israel and Palestine. I'm trying to understand this league. We have people who would go up and tell us, me and Fish and some of my other buddies on the Tel Aviv Lightning, they'd say, "You're thinking about going to Ramallah? You're crazy. You're going to die." We had other people saying, "Oh, it's fine. It's no big deal." And in fact, earlier, before that day in Palestine chapter in the book, we had a day off and me and a couple buddies tried to drive in and it was a horrible failure. We took a wrong turn. We got lost in the middle of the night. We showed up at a checkpoint. We had no idea where it was. It was a total mess. And so when Nate and I actually did it for real, going to the West Bank, we didn't know what to expect. So we ended up staying with a friend of mine from back in the day. And the very first story that we think it's fine, we're a little bit nervous, but the very first story that she tells us in Ramallah is the last two friends she had staying with her were kidnapped. We're in a taxi and they had to jump out of this taxi. So we didn't know what to make of this, heads or tails. But when it was all said and done, those 2 days were super powerful. When we were leaving my friend Susan's house to get picked up outside of a checkpoint on the other side, on the Israel side, I had a baseball in my bag and some kids, you know, two large-ish white guys walking around Ramallah. We stuck out. We smiled and we were friendly, but we clearly stuck out like a sore thumb. And I turn and I see two kids who are looking at me. And I think, now if these two kids were in Israel, they could be fans at the game. They could love the game. Baseball is a great game. Anybody on planet Earth could love this game. So I turned, I took the baseball out of my backpack. I got down on the knee. I said, "Come on over here, kid." And he took the ball from me. And then his other little friend, who was a little bit less courageous, he came out from the shadows. And pretty soon on this little side street in Ramallah, two kids are playing catch. And so I left them with the ball and we went on their way. And I don't know if that was really planting the seeds of baseball in Palestine, but I certainly like to think so.
Well, I know this. I would want Fish to be on my team. He seems like such a great person.
He is a character. You know, I signed an option for the TV rights. You clearly haven't seen it on the big screen, so it hasn't come to fruition. But when the guy who had the option for the book and who was considered making it into a movie, the very first thing after signing the contract was, "We need to get the rights from Nate Fish." And so Nate's still a buddy. I'm still in contact with him. Nate actually signed over the rights, his character, to this production company who was thinking about making a movie, and I said they hadn't. But this guy, DJ, street artist, third baseman from the Bronx, long, long black curly hair, like a biblical Solomon. You could picture that. He was a catcher at Cincinnati. His roommate, his college roommate, was Kevin Youkilis, who I'm sure everybody in your area knows. Since then, since this league, he's gone on to a career in baseball. He was running baseball. He didn't quite make Aliyah, which is to kind of move to Israel and become a citizen, but he lived in Israel for a long, long time, running baseball in Israel. Since then, he's back doing some World Baseball Classic stuff with Team Israel. He was on that team. He was on that team as a manager, and just about as charismatic as a dude as they come.
We're talking with Aaron Pribble about his book, Pitching in the Promised Land. Can you talk about some of the physical challenges that playing baseball in Israel presented?
Absolutely. Well, the one that jumps off right off the bat is that there was no ice. We did not have ice after games. So now there's some discussion, is ice good, is ice bad? But basically, when we were playing, it was standard. You pitch and you ice down your elbow, you ice down the shoulder. It was just standard. But after games, that did not exist. Now, where we were staying, everyone together, there was kind of like a liquor store gas station across the freeway. And so we had to run across the freeway. There's no crosswalk or anything, but assuming you made it safely past the darting cars driving down the highway to Guy's gas station, you could sometimes buy some ice. But if Guy didn't have any ice at his gas station liquor store, you could not ice your arm. That was just one of many examples. For people who are used to getting trainer beforehand, treatment afterwards, it just didn't exist. Now, part of that is you got to suck it up. What do you expect? You just got to play the game. But, you know, if you're a pitcher and you got a little bit of a sore arm, literally not having ice is a big deal. If I could just add one more thing, those are some of the physical challenges, but the logistics of making the game safe. You know, if you've ever seen like In and Out or a pregame warm-up where guys are taking batting practice, they're hitting grounders to some of the fielders, it is a bit of a symphony. There's a lot of balls flying around, and to the untrained eye, it can seem kind of chaotic, but there is a method to the madness. People come to expect balls being in certain places at certain times, and if you don't have screens, like if you're pitching batting practice and there's no screen, you're going to get hit. So there's a number of screens situated on the field. Well, we didn't have some of these at the field, the converted softball field with the light pole in right field. We didn't have some of these necessary screens. So what started out as kind of a joke and this is funny became quickly very, very serious when one of the league's best players, tall, strong, handsome Dominican, we call him Ray Ray, he got hit in the back of the head by a screaming line drive in batting practice. He was knocked out. He was going through seizures. He was taken to the emergency room and he survived, but he never played in the league again. And after that, I think everyone went from, oh, this is kind of funny, to this is really serious, because Ray Ray could have died.
You also weren't getting fed exactly the most varied meal.
We were certainly not. At the kfar, which is this kind of kibbutz, there is a cafeteria, and it was a kosher cafeteria. So, you know, each meal you could mix the meat and the milk products. There was a frozen yogurt machine, believe it or not, in like a cupboard, but you couldn't do it with the meat meals. You couldn't mix the meat and the milk products. So once people caught on to the fact that, first of all, we're going to have hummus with every meal. We're going to have the Israeli salad of diced cucumber and tomatoes. We're going to have that with every meal. There's going to be some couscous. There's going to be some schnitzel, which is the breaded chicken. That's basically what you're going to have meal after meal after meal. But if you can sneak into the froyo cabinet, then life is pretty good. So, you know, you figure out which guy is the guy working behind in the cafeteria, get to be on a first name basis with him. Yeah, maybe we ate some schnitzel for dinner, but you got to have some dessert. So, hey, think you can open up the cabinet? And guys were literally like bribing the cafeteria workers to open up the froyo cabinet and get a chocolate and vanilla swirl at the end of the meal.
Well, you're back as a teacher now, Aaron. As you look back with the benefit of time, what did this year playing baseball in Israel mean to you as a person?
You know, I was going back and looking through the book and thinking about my experience. I was actually texting with just yesterday, Jeff Hastings, the right fielder on the Tel Aviv Lightning for me. We're still in touch, and he lives in New Hampshire, close to you guys, and so he may be listening now. We're still in contact. He was at my wedding. I'm still friends with Nate Fish and a number of these guys. So I think if you talk to baseball players, they'll say, first and foremost, other than the game, It's really about the relationships that you build. And talk about forging a bond, this unique experience there. You know, you can talk with people about it, but being able to text someone or FaceTime or just talk with someone who was there, who lived it with you, there's nothing like it. So I love, love, love that I'm still in contact with these guys and that we remain good friends. You know, it's taught me a lot about who I am. If anything, it made me more comfortable as a Jew, as a Jewish person, you know, not really having a bar mitzvah, being a little bit unsure of my place in the world, of who I was. I left the summer seeing every, you know, Jews look like any human being on the planet, the whole racial rainbow. And so I felt very much more comfortable with who I was. I had a pretty successful season in Israel. I'd been teaching for 3 years. I'd quote unquote retired, given up my lifelong love, which I still dream about regularly, which is playing baseball. I'd quote unquote retired, been out of the game for 3 years. I had a pretty good season, and I was offered a contract to go play in the Atlantic League on the East Coast, which is a pretty darn good independent league. And I thought really hard about it. I was supposed to go back to start my new job. I was now a rookie in another profession, as you mentioned, education. And I had to decide, am I going to continue my boyhood dream, the thing that I've wanted in this life more than anything else? Or as that ship sailed, is it time to be a grown up? And I think you can guess what decision that I made. But I tell you, in addition to learning more about myself, learning more about the world, I still think about, did I make the right decision? Would I had a shot? Should I have gone back and play? I still think about that.
Well, it is a terrific read, Pitching in the Promised Land, a story of the first and only season in the Israel Baseball League. Aaron, great to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time with us today.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.